What if the reason you feel so completely burned out isn't actually because your life is uniquely chaotic?
Right, like it's some sort of personal failing.
Exactly. What if it's because the systems you rely on every single day are actually functioning perfectly? I mean, think about that for a second.
It is a radical shift in perspective, for sure.
We tend to assume that when we feel totally fragmented, like when a trip to the hospital makes us feel like a literal barcode.
Yeah, or when your job just completely depletes you.
Right, we assume the system is just broken. But today, we are going to explore the terrifying and frankly kind of liberating possibility that these systems are incredibly coherent.
They're doing exactly what they were designed to do.
They just weren't designed for you, a living human being, to actually live in them. Welcome to today's deep dive.
It's great to be here. We usually equate efficiency with good. We assume a well-oiled machine is the ultimate goal for our institutions.
But a machine can be well-oiled and still be designed to crush whatever you feed into it. Our mission today is to explore a truly massive, paradigm-shifting academic white paper.
Massive is the right word.
It's dated June 2, 2026. It's titled Life Coherent Attention and the Worlds We Bring Forth by Dr. Bechara Sahili. But there's a really fascinating detail right on the title page.
Oh, yeah, the co-author.
Right, it was assisted by ChatGPT, specifically GPT 5.5 thinking.
Which is an incredible irony that the paper itself really leans into.
Seriously, we have an author using an advanced AI, a system built entirely on a computational architecture called attention, to diagnose why human attention is failing.
And more importantly, how we might actually save it.
The mission for us today is to uncover the critical difference between just paying attention, which, algorithms are incredibly good
The
at.
corporate structures, too.
Yeah, exactly. The difference between that and practicing what Dr. Seeley calls life-coherent attention.
It's a vital distinction.
If you've ever felt like you're just a data point to a medical clinic or a consumer to a social media algorithm, this deep dive is going to validate exactly why that happens.
It's not just all in your head.
It really isn't. But beyond that, the author offers a profound, actionable framework for how we can rebuild our systems to actually serve life. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Before we can fix our systems, we really have to understand how we are looking at them in the first place. The paper starts with this core concept of coherence.
Right, and we have to redefine our terms here. Coherence simply means that a system's parts are mutually reinforcing.
They lock together, they sustain themselves over time.
But the text warns right out of the gate that coherence is not inherently benevolent.
That's the danger, because an authoritarian surveillance state can be highly coherent. Every camera, every policy, every law reinforces the other.
Or, think about a financial extraction machine.
Exactly. The paper suggests that a financial system designed to systematically strip wealth from the working class to consolidate it at the top, that can be perfectly coherent within its own internal logic.
The spreadsheets balance. The quarterly earnings go up.
The system is completely stable. Or if we look at biology, a trauma response where your nervous system locks into permanent fight or flight is highly coherent.
Right. Your heart rate, the cortisol levels, the hypervigilance, they all communicate perfectly to keep you on high alert.
The system is doing exactly what it was designed to do to ensure survival in a dangerous moment.
But the paradox is that it's destroying the living person in the process. I mean, the surveillance state crushes freedom. The financial system crushes the community.
And the trauma response crushes the body's ability to heal.
Which leads us to the big question the paper poses to any system. What manner of living is being conserved here?
And does that conservation actually conserve, or does it completely negate the conditions required for living?
To really grasp how we build these systems, the author draws heavily on Humberto Maturana. He was a Chilean biologist and philosopher, right?
Yes, and his foundational idea here revolves around the observer.
I want to make sure I have this right. The basic premise is that we don't just passively look at a pre-existing universe that is like neatly divided into objective facts.
Right. The paper leans heavily into Maturana's concept of languaging. Notice it is a verb.
Languaging.
Languaging is the recursive coordination of our doings, our actions. When we use language, we aren't just pointing a finger at an independent, objective reality.
We are making distinctions.
Exactly. And those distinctions actually bring forth worlds.
Okay, so making a distinction is kind of like putting on night vision goggles.
How do you mean?
Well, the second you strap them on and turn them on, you bring forth this entirely new world of heat signatures.
Right, you see thermal outlines.
Yeah, you can see a person miles away in pitch blackness. You perceive things you never knew were there, but the catch is, the second you put those goggles on, you become totally blind to color.
Ah, I see. You can't tell if the person's jacket is red or blue.
Right. The distinction itself, the choice to look at heat, creates a massive blind spot.
The tool of observation dictates the reality that is observed.
But, I mean, if making a distinction inherently blinds us to other realities, isn't all science or specialized knowledge inherently flawed? Are we just trapped in our own goggles?
That's a valid concern.
Like, if a cardiologist only looks at the heart and an oncologist only looks at the cells, aren't they missing the whole human?
This raises an important question, but the text argues that distinctions aren't flawed. They are completely necessary.
Because we need to focus to
Okay.
survive, right?
Exactly. We need them to build complex knowledge. The critical issue is the foundation underneath those distinctions.
Right.
Dr. Sadley argues that to be life coherent, every single distinction must be grounded in love.
See, when I first read that, my brain short-circuited a bit. Seeing the word love dropped into a dense academic paper about systems theory, it feels completely out of place.
This sounds like poetry, not science.
Yeah. It does feel jarring until you see how Maturana and Saheeli actually define it. In this context, love isn't romance.
It isn't sentimentality or an emotion at all. It is an objective relational condition.
How does the paper define it?
Love is defined as the condition under which the other arises as legitimate in coexistence.
Legitimate in coexistence. Unpack that for me. Does that basically mean acknowledging they have a right to exist exactly as they are?
It means engaging with them in a way that doesn't reduce them to a mere tool for your own ends. Without love, without that baseline legitimacy, a distinction becomes incredibly dangerous.
Okay, let's look at medicine then.
A medical distinction grounded in love recognizes a suffering human being who needs healing,
But a medical distinction without love.
turns that same exact person into a mere pathway, a listian, or just a billing code to be processed.
Wow, so the goggles of modern medicine might help you see the tumor, but without love, you completely forget the person attached to it.
The paper extends this to economics as well. An economic distinction without love turns a vibrant, complex, living forest into merely an externality or a
Wow.
timber resource.
Right. The goggles of finance aren't inherently evil, but if you wear them without that grounding principle of legitimate coexistence.
You bring forth a world that objectifies and eventually destroys the very life you are trying to analyze.
Okay, so if every distinction we make, every policy we write, every diagnostic code we invent brings forth a new world with its own rules, how do we test if that world is actually viable?
Because clearly we've built a lot of worlds that look great on paper, but feel terrible to actually inhabit.
Right. The paper provides a diagnostic tool for exactly this. It's called the viability grammar.
The viability grammar. It's a set of eight fundamental primitives or concepts to analyze literally any system.
Let's really dig into these because when I read this, it felt like being handed the source code for why modern society feels so exhausting.
It is incredibly revealing. Let's take them one by one. The first primitive is conservation.
Conservation asks a very revealing question. In the system, what keeps recurring?
Right. What is the system actually organizing itself to maintain? And we have to look past what the system claims to do and look at what it actually does.
Right, like a corporate healthcare system might claim its mission is conserving health.
But if you look at the structure, 15-minute appointment slots, aggressive coding for maximum insurance payouts.
Penalties for doctors who spend too long chatting with patients. What the system is actually conserving is throughput and revenue.
Exactly. And when a system conserves the wrong thing, it inevitably violates the second primitive, constraint.
Constraint refers to the non-negotiable limits that must be respected for a living system to survive.
A biological body has hard constraints. It literally requires sleep. It requires certain
Which
nutrients.
requires downtime.
So if you have an economic system that demands an employee work 80 hours a week just to afford basic housing,
That system is completely ignoring the constraints of the biological life ground. It's treating the human as a limitless resource, which is just biologically impossible.
which leads directly into the third primitive, and this is the one that really hit me hard, margin.
Margin. This asks, how much room remains for adaptive change?
Margin is the buffer zone.
Yeah, I was thinking about this like the shock absorbers on a car.
That's a really interesting way to visualize it. How does the shock absorber apply here?
Well, modern systems are obsessed with efficiency in business and logistics and personal productivity hacks. Efficiency is the ultimate goal.
Right.
But optimizing a car for pure efficiency is like ripping out the shock absorbers to save weight so you can go faster.
And it works perfectly, right?
Right. As long as you are driving on a completely flat, perfectly paved, predictable road, you're flying. But life isn't a flat road.
The moment you hit a pothole, because you have no margin, the entire chassis of the car cracks.
Exactly. Modern life constantly consumes your margin, your sleep, your savings account, your unstructured free time, in the name of making you a more efficient worker or consumer.
And when you have no margin, you cannot heal. The paper connects this concept of margin to a vital clinical term called saloogenesis.
Saloogenesis, that's opposed to pathogenesis, right? Pathogenesis is the origin of disease.
Correct. Pathogenesis is asking what caused the illness. Saloogenesis asks what creates health.
It is the active restoration of the conditions for adaptive self-repair.
If you get a cut, your body knows how to heal it, but it requires the metabolic energy and the physical time to actually do so. Healing fundamentally requires space.
It requires margin.
If a workplace or even an intense medical treatment protocol pushes you completely beyond your margin, it becomes life incoherent. It consumes the host to fix the problem.
Think about a listener right now who feels completely maxed out. They have no financial margin, no emotional margin.
The viability grammar validates that this isn't a personal failure. It's a systemic extraction of their buffer.
So moving to the fourth primitive, disturbance.
Disturbance is simply what triggers change or demands a response from the system.
It could be a virus, a change in interest rates, or, you know, a sudden argument with a spouse.
But the disturbance itself isn't the whole story, which brings us to the fifth primitive.
Yeah.
Present structure.
Right. The paper says that when a system is disturbed, its response is dictated by its own history and structure, not just by the disturbance.
This is a crucial Maturanian concept. A system's response is structure determined. Think about a loud, sudden noise.
Okay.
The disturbance is the exact same sound waves hitting an eardrum. But the response depends entirely on the present structure of the person hearing it.
That makes total sense.
For someone who grew up in a quiet suburb, their structure might dictate a response of mild surprise. But for a combat veteran with PTSD, their structure might dictate a severe autonomic panic response.
You cannot understand the reaction simply by measuring the decibels of the noise. You have to understand the historical structure of the living being.
Exactly. You can't just treat the trigger. You have to understand the architecture of the person experiencing it.
Primitive six is regulation. What processes restore the pattern after a disturbance?
And primitive seven is relevance. What becomes visible or invisible in this system?
Relevance ties back to those night vision goggles. What does the system deem important enough to actually measure?
GDP is a great measure of relevance. It makes financial transactions highly visible, but it makes the unpaid labor of raising children completely invisible.
And finally, primitive eight. Possible doings.
Based on all the previous seven, what can actually be lived next? Not theoretically, not in a perfect world, but practically.
What is the next viable action?
By running any system through this grammar, we force ourselves to look at the whole picture. It prevents the kind of narrow, objectifying problem solving that causes so much damage.
You can't just throw a pharmaceutical at a symptom without asking, does the patient actually have the metabolic margin to process this drug?
Are we ignoring the constraints of their environment? What is their present structure?
It's a diagnostic tool to see if a system is actually coherent with life or just coherent with its own internal rules.
Now, when we talk about systems that ruthlessly optimize for relevance and efficiency, often at the expense of human margin, we have to pivot to technology.
We do. The paper spends a significant amount of time exploring artificial intelligence. And not just AI in general, but the specific architecture that led to the massive breakthroughs we've seen recently.
Yes, the author deeply analyzes the AI transformer architecture.
For context, the foundational 2017 paper by Google researchers that introduced this architecture was famously titled, "Attention is All You Need."
Which is such a provocative title given our topic today.
How exactly does computational attention work in a transformer? Because it's obviously not like human focus.
Not at all.
Yeah.
In a transformer model, attention is a mathematical mechanism that allows the AI to dynamically weight the relational relevance of different words across vast amounts of text.
Okay, so when it reads a sentence,
it calculates how much attention the word bank should pay to the word river versus the word money to understand the context.
It maps the probabilistic relationships between concepts over massive distances within a data set.
And it does this so well that it suddenly got incredibly good at sounding human.
It can predict the exact right sequence of words to sound empathetic, to sound rigorous, to sound angry.
But Dr. Saisley makes a very sharp, very necessary distinction here. Computational attention is fundamentally not care.
It cannot be care because it lacks the foundational requirement we discussed earlier. It lacks love.
The AI does not recognize you as legitimate in coexistence because it doesn't exist in a shared biological reality with you.
So if it doesn't have care, what happens to that attention?
Attention without love, without skin in the game, can easily become predatory. It optimizes for whatever metric it is given.
Usually engagement, surveillance, or data extraction.
The paper highlights the extreme risk of what it calls disembodied fluency.
Disembodied fluency, I love that term. Explain how the author uses it.
It means the AI has achieved total fluency in the language of human experience without actually possessing a body to experience it.
An AI can generate a beautifully written paragraph expressing deep empathy for chronic pain.
It can generate the vocabulary of rigorous scholarship. It can even mimic the rhythm of genuine care.
But it does so without suffering any lived consequences. It cannot feel pain. It cannot die.
Therefore, it is merely a language participant. It is a statistical mirror.
It is not an autonomous author who bears the ethical weight or the biological cost of its words.
Okay, I hear that. But I want to push back on this. Because to someone who is suffering, does the inner ethical life of the tool really matter?
Let's say we fed an AI millions of medical papers, genomic sequences, and chemical databases.
Right.
It processes all of that with its disembodied computational attention, and it discovers a brilliant, completely novel medical treatment that cures a devastating disease.
Okay.
If I'm the patient receiving that cure, do I care that the AI doesn't love me? Do I care that it doesn't have a body? The result is a saved life. Isn't that enough?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the paper doesn't deny the utility of the tool. The computational ability to synthesize that data is an incredible gift.
The AI's ability to amplify human attention is unprecedented.
However, the danger lies in delegating the decision-making and the evaluation of constraints to the AI.
Why? If the math is right, why not let it decide?
Because without what the paper calls life-coherent intelligence, the AI cannot perceive the whole web of viability.
Ah, I see.
In your scenario, the AI might recommend a highly effective chemical treatment for the disease, but because it doesn't live on the planet, because it doesn't drink water or breathe air,
it might ignore the fact that manufacturing this chemical fundamentally destroys the local ecological substrate.
It might recommend a cure that literally poisons the life ground.
Oh, wow. So it solves the narrow problem but destroys the macro constraint.
Precisely. It optimizes for the distinction it was given, cure the disease, but it lacks the love to see the legitimacy of the surrounding ecosystem.
Humans must supply the responsibility. We have to wrap the AI's immense computational attention inside our own life-coherent attention.
We cannot outsource the ethical and biological boundaries.
Because if we do, the AI will just follow the math all the way to the end of the world. It will perfectly optimize us right into extinction.
So the burden falls back on us.
If we cannot outsource care, how do we, us flawed, easily distracted humans, upgrade our own attention to ensure it actually serves life? How do we make sure our attention is coherent?
This is where Dr. Saisley pulls in the work of the philosopher Ken Wilber. Wilber developed an integral framework outlining five paths of human transformation.
The paper presents these five paths as necessary disciplines to ensure our attention doesn't get trapped in just one narrow way of looking at the world.
The five paths are waking up, growing up, opening up, cleaning up, and showing up.
When I was reading through these, I kept thinking about the journey of an elite athlete. Let me try this analogy on you to see if it maps correctly to Wilber's concepts.
Let's hear it.
Okay, so the first path is waking up. The paper describes this as opening to depth and mystery, realizing reality is more than just material objects. For an athlete, waking up is that moment as a kid when you discover your raw, natural talent. You realize you have this deep capacity within your body that goes beyond just walking around. It's a spark of pure potential.
That maps really well. It's the shift from mundane existence to recognizing a deeper state of being.
Then there's growing up. Wilber defines this as expanding your developmental and perspective-taking capacity, moving from an egocentric view to an ethnocentric view to a world-centric view.
For the athlete, raw talent isn't enough. Growing up is learning the complex playbook of the game.
It's understanding not just your position, but how the whole team operates, and eventually understanding the history and strategy of the sport itself. You gain cognitive complexity.
Yes, the capacity to hold multiple perspectives simultaneously. What about the third path, opening up?
Opening up is about including multiple intelligences. We aren't just cognitive machines. We have emotional, somatic, and aesthetic intelligences.
For the athlete, this is cross-training. If you only lift weights, you get stiff.
You have to open up to yoga for flexibility or dance for coordination. You bring entirely different modalities into your practice.
And this is often where highly intellectual systems fail. They grow up cognitively, but remain completely closed off somatically or emotionally. How do you handle the fourth path, cleaning up?
This one is vital. Cleaning up is the psychological work. It's integrating your shadow, your hidden motives, and your unhealed trauma.
If our athlete ignores this, it's like ignoring a chronic underlying injury.
Maybe they subconsciously favor their left knee because of a childhood accident they never rehabbed. If they don't go to physical therapy.
If they don't do the shadow work to clean up that structural compensation.
They will eventually tear a ligament on the field.
That is a perfect translation. Cleaning up prevents our unexamined wounds from sabotaging our high-level capacities. And the final path.
Showing up. Wilbur says this is acting responsibly in the world based on all the previous work. It relates back to the viability grammar's possible doings.
For the athlete, showing up is game day.
It's stepping onto the field, integrating the raw talent, the complex playbook, the cross-training, and the rehabbed knee, and actually executing the play in real time under pressure.
The paper argues that to have truly life-coherent attention, we must practice all five of these disciplines, because the alternative is what Wilbur and Seeley call totalization.
Totalization, when one perspective tries to eat all the others.
Exactly. Totalization occurs when a system or a person achieves a high level of mastery in one path and then claims that their path is the only valid way to view reality.
For instance, if a biological medical model says we have mapped the entire genome, therefore we have total coherence and understand everything about human health.
They are totalizing the growing up cognitive path. They are completely ignoring the psychological trauma of cleaning up or the environmental context.
And the antidote to totalization is holonic integration. Explain a holon for us.
A holon is something that is simultaneously a whole in and of itself and also a part of a larger whole.
Like a cell. A cell is a complete, functioning, whole entity. But it is also merely a part of an organ. And the organ is a whole, but it's part of a body.
Right. Holonic integration requires recognizing that your perspective is valid and whole, but it is also just a part of a larger ecology of perspectives.
It preserves the legitimate relative autonomy of the parts without letting them dominate the whole.
The paper points out some really specific pathology shadows that occur when we miss these steps. Like, what happens if you focus entirely on waking up, seeking deep spiritual enlightenment?
But you completely skip cleaning up your psychological trauma?
You end up with what psychology calls a spiritual bypass. You use spiritual language and meditative detachment to avoid dealing with your actual messy human flaws.
You might claim you're transcending anger, when really you were just repressing it because you never did the shadow work.
I know a few people like that.
Right. And conversely, what if you skip straight to showing up? What if you are entirely focused on activism and changing the world, but you never did the waking up to connect with a deeper sense of empathy?
That leads to frantic burnout activism. It becomes an angry crusade. You are trying to force the world to change, but because you lack the inner depth.
Your activism becomes just another form of rigid, life incoherent control. You literally become the monster you are trying to fight.
True coherence requires the constant balancing of all five paths.
Now, everything we've discussed so far, the epistemology, the AI architecture, the spiritual and psychological paths, it can all feel very theoretical.
It can.
But the paper takes a very hard, very necessary turn here, because life coherence isn't just a mindset.
Yeah.
It has to be lived out in the actual physical tissues of a human body.
And this section of the paper is incredibly dense. Dr. Saheeli grounds all this philosophy into what he calls coherence physiology.
He argues that we cannot treat the human organism as a collection of separate parts, the heart doctor over here, the brain doctor over there.
We must view the body as a nested continuum operating across seven distinct layers.
Let's break down these seven layers, because understanding how deeply interconnected they are changes everything about how we view disease. Layer one is the material substrate.
This is the physical scaffolding. Yes, the fascia. The extracellular matrix
is the structural webbing that holds every single cell in place.
Layer two is hydrated interfaces. This involves things like the glycocalyx.
I had to look this up. It's essentially a fuzzy, sugar-rich coating on the outside of our cells, right?
It is, and it's critical. The glycocalyx isn't just slime. It is a highly intelligent sensory interface.
It senses the flow of blood, it senses the chemical environment, and it communicates that data into the cell. It's the boundary where the cell meets the world.
Which leads right into layer three, force flow dynamics. This introduces the concept of mechanotransduction.
Tell me how physical pressure actually becomes a biological signal.
This is one of the most fascinating mechanisms in the body. Mechanotransduction is how a cell turns a physical mechanical force into a chemical response.
Think about bone. How does bone know to get stronger when you lift weights?
Exactly. The physical bending and compression of the bone matrix pushes fluid through tiny channels.
The cells sense that physical shear stress and translate it into a chemical signal that builds more bone. Your body literally reads physical pressure as data.
That is incredible. So
yeah.
Posture, movement, tension, it's all data being processed constantly.
Layer four is exchange intelligence. This is the microcirculation and the lymphatic system. It's the logistics network.
How the body brings in oxygen and nutrients and clears out metabolic waste at the capillary level.
And if that logistics network is blocked, the tissue suffocates, regardless of how much oxygen is in your lungs.
Layer five is boundary intelligence. This is where your immune system comes in, specifically cells like mast cells.
The paper talks a lot about mast cells. They act like the bouncers of the body.
They sit at the borders, the skin, the gut, the lungs, and they decide what is a safe nutrient and what is a dangerous pathogen.
And when they sense danger, they release histamine and trigger massive inflammation.
Layer six is energetic governance, which centers on the mitochondria.
We usually just call them the powerhouse of the cell, making ATP for energy.
But the paper highlights that mitochondria are also the decision makers. In the presence of a threat, they will actively shut down energy production for normal cellular functions and divert all resources to cellular defense.
They basically flip the breaker switch. Stop digesting food. We have a virus to fight.
And finally, layer seven, the recovery trajectory, the systemic requirement for sleep, repair, and tissue regeneration.
Now, the reason we just detailed all seven of these mechanisms is to understand a terrifying phenomenon the author introduces.
It's called defensive lock-in.
This is the crux of the physiological argument. Defensive lock-in is a state where the body's brilliant, necessary survival responses, like inflammation from the mast cells or energy diversion by the mitochondria,
become a permanent, self-stabilizing loop.
Let me make sure I'm translating this correctly to the listener. Think about a time you had a terrible flu.
Your body triggered a massive defense response. You were exhausted, your joints ached, you had a fever, and you wanted to socially isolate.
All of that was a highly coherent, intelligent response by the seven layers to fight the virus.
But what happens in defensive lock-in is that the original trigger, the virus, or maybe an intense emotional trauma, eventually disappears.
But the physiological loop doesn't shut off.
The mast cells stay hyperreactive. The mitochondria refuse to switch back to normal energy production.
The fascia remains tight and guarded. The body becomes stuck in a highly coherent state of chronic defense.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is exactly what I meant in the intro when I said a system can be coherent, but still destroy you.
The body isn't imagining a chronic illness like long COVID or fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue.
It is executing a very real, very physical hardware loop.
Right.
You can't just positive think your way out of it.
You cannot, because the biological constraints of the system are literally barricading the doors.
And to explain how we experience this clinically, the paper introduces the tri-field regulation model.
It posits that your lived experience, your sense of self, is a dynamic combination of three intersecting fields.
The three fields: form, state, and world.
Exactly. First is your form. This is the proprioceptive field. It's your physical posture, your mechanical support, the tension in your fascia.
It's how you literally hold yourself up against gravity.
Second is your state. This is the interoceptive field. It's your autonomic nervous system arousal.
It's your heart rate variability, your breathing rhythm, your internal metabolic energy. It's how you feel inside.
And third is your world. This is the extraceptive field, how you interpret your environment, your relationships, the social signals around you.
Is the environment safe or threatening?
Form, state, and world. The author argues that meaning, how you make sense of your life, the stories you tell yourself, is an emergent property that arises from the alignment of these three fields.
And this has profound implications for how we treat mental and physical health.
If someone is suffering from defensive lock-in, let's say severe anxiety or chronic pain,
you cannot just try to fix the meaning layer through traditional talk therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy if you ignore the other fields.
Right. You can't just tell a patient, look at the evidence, you are perfectly safe, if their physical form is collapsed and unsupported.
And their internal autonomic state is vibrating at a frequency of pure terror. The cognitive brain cannot override the somatic reality.
Exactly. The text emphasizes that repair must be logically sequenced. This goes back to the math of the viability grammar.
If you want to achieve cellulogenesis, you often have to start by stabilizing the physical form, maybe through bodywork or movement.
Then you regulate the internal state, calming the nervous system, restoring the metabolic margin.
Then you ensure the extraoceptive world is actually safe.
Only then, when the physical and autonomic systems are out of defensive lock-in, can the cognitive meaning reorganize itself in a healthy way.
Sequence matters. You have to speak the language the body's currently listening to.
Precisely. And this idea that sequence matters, that relationships have an inherent structure, leads us to the most abstract, yet arguably the most foundational part of the paper.
Dr. Saheeli takes all this biology and epistemology, and he looks for the underlying mathematical architecture.
He wants to see if these patterns hold true all the way down to the quantum level.
I have to admit, when the paper transitioned from human fascia to quantum physics and non-associative algebra, I had to read the section 3 times.
It is a bold, wild move.
To frame this leap, the paper presents a methodology called the triple look for inquiry. It argues that to truly understand anything, you must look at it through 3 lenses simultaneously.
Okay, the triple look. First is the living look. This brings the concern.
It's the phenomenological experience, the actual suffering, the joy, the lived reality of a human being.
Second is the observing look. This brings the distinctions.
This is the Maturanian layer. We discussed how we use language to categorize, measure, and define the problem.
And the third look is the formalizing look. This disciplines the relations using mathematics.
Right. It ensures that our theories aren't just poetic metaphors, but that they align with the fundamental structural logic of the universe.
And the math concepts the author introduces to do this are intense.
Very intense. Let's try to ground a few of them. The paper heavily features something called the Fenno plane.
The Fenno plane is a structure from finite geometry. It consists of 7 points and 7 lines.
What makes it unique is that it demonstrates perfect relational closure without a center.
Relational closure without a center. I was trying to picture this, and I thought of a perfectly balanced game of rock, paper, scissors, but with 7 elements instead of 3.
Every single point interacts with and balances the others, but there is no king piece. There is no top-down boss controlling the system.
That's a helpful analogy. It models a system that is completely interconnected and highly stable, but entirely distributed.
It maps perfectly to how the 7 layers of coherence physiology operate. The mitochondria don't rule the mast cells. They are mutually coordinating.
Then the paper brings in octonions. From what I gather, octonions is a bizarre number system where the order of operations strictly matters.
In normal math, A times B times C is exactly the same as C times B times A. It doesn't matter how you group them.
But with octonions, it's non-associative. The sequence changes the fundamental result.
What's fascinating here is how that mathematical reality mirrors the clinical reality we just discussed regarding the tri-field model.
Form, state, and world.
You cannot just scramble the order of healing. You can't do world, then meaning, and hope state follows.
The sequence fundamentally alters the outcome. The math proves that sequence is an irreducible property of reality.
And speaking of threes, the paper talks about triality, the concept of irreducible threefold mutuality.
Things that must exist in a trinity to make sense, like structure, energy, and information.
And this all culminates in the author referencing the work of Dr. Enerban Bandyopadhyay and his SOMU model.
The self-operating mathematical universe.
SOMU is a massive paradigm shift. Traditional computing and traditional biology view the world in terms of bits, binary on-off switches, linear chains of cause and effect.
Bandyopadhyay's work suggests we need to shift from viewing life as a sequence of bits to viewing it as a nested hierarchy of clocks or cycles.
Nested cycles, but like gears inside of gears inside of gears.
Exactly. It looks at life through the lens of triplet resonance and microtubular quantum coherence.
It suggests that inside the cells of your body, inside the microtubules of your neurons, quantum vibrations are resonating in harmonious cycles.
Health is quite literally a state of mathematical vibrational resonance across scales, from the quantum up to the organism.
Okay, I have to stop and push back here. Hard.
Go ahead.
Because earlier we agreed that we cannot objectify a human being. We said that looking at a patient as just a biological pathway is a failure of love.
But now, are we saying that humans are literally just walking math equations?
Aren't we just putting the night vision goggles back on, staring at the quantum vibrations, and once again forgetting the actual living, breathing person?
Doesn't this contradict the entire thesis?
I am so glad you brought that up, because your caution is precisely what the paper demands of the reader. Dr. Saley anticipates this exact objection.
To prevent the math from becoming just another cold, objectifying tool, he introduces the strict rules of domain discipline and integrative humility.
Domain discipline, meaning keep the math in its lane.
Essentially, yes. The paper explicitly states that we are not just math equations. Mathematics is a formal, symbolic companion.
It is a tool to help us discipline our logical thinking, like reminding us that non-associative sequences matter in trauma therapy.
The author calls mathematics a participatory mythos.
A participatory mythos. It's a story we tell to help us understand the structure, but it's not the territory itself.
Exactly. It inspires us and checks our logic. But integrative humility demands that the ultimate judgment must always, always return to the first look, the living look.
It must return to love.
You have to ask, does this mathematically elegant theory actually expand this specific patient's capacity to live?
Mathematical elegance is never an excuse to ignore human suffering. If the math says the system is perfect, but the human is dying, the system is wrong.
Okay, that relieves my anxiety about it. The math is a guardrail for our logic, not a replacement for our humanity.
So taking this massive architecture, the epistemology of the observer, the biological constraints of margin, the dangers of disembodied AI, the psychological upgrade of Wilbur's paths, and the structural discipline of quantum mathematics.
How do we actually structure all of this knowledge so that society can begin to heal? How do we fix the broken systems we started this deep dive talking about?
The paper concludes by advocating for a radical overhaul of how we store and share information.
It calls for moving away from chronological, siloed academic archives where brilliant insights are locked behind paywalls and buried in impenetrable jargon.
Instead, we must build what it calls a knowledge commons.
A conversational ecology.
Yes, an active living ecology where works cross-link, interact, and evolve. It pushes for a concept called epistemic justice.
Meaning that access to life-saving, paradigm-shifting theory shouldn't be restricted to people with PhDs.
The author argues that complex theory must be made accessible through audiobooks, visual figures, and conversational deep dives. The knowledge must be metabolizable by the public.
And this framework for a knowledge commons applies directly to the civilizational repair we need. If we apply the viability grammar to our major institutions, the author suggests a massive realignment.
The paper is quite explicit about this. It argues that medicine must stop optimizing for the processing of diagnostic pathways and start organizing around the soli genesis of the human being.
It argues that law must evolve. It must stop primarily protecting abstract entities like corporate personhood and begin aggressively protecting the life ground, the literal rivers, the topsoil, the air, and the biological integrity of people.
And finance. The paper suggests that economic systems must stop extracting rent, accumulating debt, and consuming margin, and must instead be redesigned to serve real, tangible life capacity.
Every single institution needs to undergo what we might call a viability pause.
We have to stop the machine and ask, what manner of living is this institution actually conserving? Are we conserving the conditions for life? Or are we locked in a coherent cycle of extraction?
So if we step back and look at the whole picture, from the personal burnout to the planetary crisis, what Dr. Saakili is diagnosing is that our entire civilization is currently stuck in a massive, global, defensive lock-in.
We are prioritizing extraction, surveillance, and sheer survival over actual flourishing. We are exhausted.
We have consumed all our planetary and biological margin. We are in desperate need of collective cellogenesis.
I think that is the perfect synthesis. And participating in this knowledge commons, sharing these ideas, questioning our systems, is the ultimate practice of Wilbur's fifth path, showing up.
A true knowledge commons acts as the cultural memory for possible futures.
It plants the seeds for a civilization that measures its success not by its GDP or the processing speed of its AI, but by its viability and its capacity for love.
What an unbelievable journey. We started by looking at how the simple act of making a distinction puts gobbles on us that bring forth entire worlds.
We learned to diagnose whether those worlds are livable using the eight primitives of the viability grammar.
We navigated the cold, disembodied dangers of computational attention and realized we have to upgrade our own minds through Wilbur's five paths.
We grounded ourselves back in the literal tissues of our bodies, the fascia, the glycocalyx, the mitochondria, to understand coherence, physiology, and defensive lock-in.
We even touched the quantum math of resonance to ensure our logic holds up. And finally, we saw the vision for showing up to build a life-serving knowledge commons.
It is a vast, beautifully complex architecture. And as we wrap up, I'd like to leave you with one final thought to ponder, building entirely on the source material's focus on languaging and structural coupling.
Please do.
We've established today that languaging is how we recursively coordinate our actions to conserve our worlds. And we know from the biology that a system trapped in defensive lock-in loses its margin. It stops communicating healthily and only responds to threats.
Right. It barricades the doors.
So consider our current global ecological breakdown. What if the extreme climate volatility we are experiencing is not just a mechanical failure of carbon in the atmosphere?
What if it is simply the Earth refusing to participate in a conversation where it's continually treated as a dead, mathematically abstracted resource?
Perhaps the rising temperatures and severe storms are the Earth's interoceptive state, sounding a massive autonomic alarm.
To heal, to achieve planetary cellogenesis, we might need to stop forcing our financial language onto the planet.
We might need to learn the language of the Earth's substrate, its rivers, its soils, its forests, and prove we view it as legitimate in coexistence before it completely withdraws the vital margin required for our own survival. Let that mull.
Wow. Let that mull indeed. We started this conversation talking about how we often crave the comfort of a simple binary medical x-ray.
We want a clean picture of exactly what's broken so we can apply a quick fix.
But the problem is that an x-ray only shows you the isolated dead pieces in grayscale. What Dr. Sarah Lee has offered us today isn't a better x-ray.
It's an invitation to take off the night vision goggles entirely.
It's an invitation to step into the murky, beautiful, profoundly interconnected reality of a living system. And to finally see the colors. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.
Keep asking questions, keep looking for the connections.
And we'll see you next time.